This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Give up hope and exit out of environmentalism? In the UK, deep greener Paul Kingsnorth says he's leaving the climate movement, which is lost anyway.
And also coming to the conclusion, and it was a very difficult conclusion to admit to myself, but I think a lot of people are starting to admit it to themselves now, coming to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we're facing can't be solved in the sense that we would like to solve them. For example, we're not going to stop climate changing. We're not going to stop the mass extinction event that we're in at the moment. Hopefully we can prevent it from getting any worse than it has to get, but we're in it and it's happening and it's too late to do a lot of things about it.
Who else is on their way out the door? This week, we'll hear a challenging interview with one of the co-founders of Greenpeace International, Michael McGonigal. He's been battling since the late 1960s. He teaches environmental law at the University of Victoria in Canada. Two hosts from the podcast The Extra Environmentalist interview Michael for Radio EcoShock about his new strategy, which he calls Exit Environmentalism. Just in case, we'll top that off with a shot at techno-optimism as well. But first, I'll talk with chemical engineer and biofuels specialist Robert Rapier. We go to the fundamentals of the energy crisis, peak oil, Asian demand, speculation, and all that. Rapier compares greenhouse gas emissions from Asia to an unstoppable hurricane. I don't agree with everything all our guests say, but Robert takes me closer to exit environmentalism with his clear, cold logic about the real world we live in. Brain stimulation from Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. How realistic are biofuels as a replacement for oil? And are we headed for energy independence or an energy crash? Robert Rapier would know. He's got 20 years' experience as a chemical engineer working with all kinds of fuels. Currently, Robert is Chief Technology Officer at Merica International, a renewables and forestry company based in Hawaii. Rapier is also Managing Editor of Consumer Energy Report and a regular guest on mainstream media. His latest book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to this energy crisis, and that's mostly what we're going to talk about, I was intrigued by your position on climate change. As an energy industry guy, your book compares greenhouse gas emissions to an unstoppable hurricane. Tell us about that.
I think we in the West tend to think that the United States and Canada, to a lesser extent, but our per capita emissions are indeed very high. And so we tend to think that we are the major problem. But if you look at global emissions, our emissions in the U.S. and Canada, in the EU, so in North America and the EU, have declined over the past 10 years. And at the same time, emissions in Asia Pacific are skyrocketing. Now, they're already higher than ours, which people don't realize that. Our per capita emissions are higher, but they have so many more people. And so when you think about how exactly we're going to address that, you know, we focus on our emissions here in the West, but if you looked, if the United States completely fell off the map, our emissions would only go back to like 1994 levels, and they would still be rapidly climbing. So we're largely focused, I think, on the wrong target. I mean, true, we need to do something about our own emissions. We need to try to set an example, but we use 10 times the oil that, say, China does per person. So we lack the moral authority, we lack the technology to show them how to develop without fossil fuels. And so it's a very difficult situation where they're coming up from a very low standard of living using just a little bit of oil, but already the little bit of oil by a whole lot of people has dwarfed our emissions and is still rapidly climbing. So it's hard to see how we get a handle on that.
And you've called the whole discussion about climate change academic, that's your phrase. You seem to be saying we should just suck it up and try to adapt. Is that your stance? And if so, are you getting flack for that?
I do get some flack for it. It's not exactly my stance. My stance is not that we should just suck it up. What I'm trying to do is project the future. And when I project the future, I say, here's what's likely to happen. What's likely to happen is we will continue, our emissions will probably continue to decline somewhat from here, but Asia Pacific's emissions are going to continue to climb unabated. I mean, it's not only Asia Pacific. Africa, the Middle East, South America, all these regions of the world, all these developing regions are rapidly increasing their fossil fuel consumption. And so I say it becomes academic because while we debate how we're going to get our emissions down, the emissions just continue to climb. And the reason I liken it to a hurricane, you know, we can talk about whether climate change is going to be really bad and disastrous and so forth, just like when we watched Hurricane Katrina come in. You know, the night before it came in, I told my wife, I said, I'm afraid this is going to destroy New Orleans. But one thing we didn't talk about is, well, how do you stop the hurricane? And that's what I see in Asia Pacific right now. The reason I say it's academic, I don't see a viable way to stop them from increasing their fossil fuel consumption because they're already at such a low level per capita. So I've likened it to a rich person trying to tell a poor person how to live within their means. You know, the poor person is just trying to scratch out a living and increase their standard of living, while the rich person has already done that. We've already increased our emissions from a very low level, and we've gotten to a high level per person. We just don't have nearly as many people as they do. So it's hard to see. I mean, the technology does not exist. No country has developed to a high level of development without fossil fuels. So to imagine that it can be done, we're imagining something that's never been done before.
Well, I agree with you generally, but I do have two points of hope. One is the pollution there is terrible, the air pollution, and I think eventually people will ask for a cleanup just to get their health better, and alternative fuels or even solar energy might help with that. And then we'll get to our main topic of discussion here, the peak oil. Perhaps the fossil fuels will be limited, and so the emissions won't go up and up forever. And one question that comes to me from some listeners, do you think Asian demand for fossil fuels is one of the reasons why North American gasoline prices are going up?
That is the single biggest reason North American gasoline prices are going up. I mean, people ask me that, and I tell them, you know, if you want to know why, look east, look to Asia, look to China. Their increase in demand over the past 10 years, I mean, their oil consumption has nearly doubled in the past decade, and it shows no signs of slowing down. That has taken all the excess capacity, or nearly all of the excess capacity of oil production out. They've consumed it all. And so that has led to a great deal of volatility, and it's led to much higher prices. That is the single biggest reason. But, of course, the fact that we consume a lot, I mean, there's another part there, and the United States consumes an awful lot of oil. So both the parts together are what's driven prices so high. Prices climbed so quickly because they increased their demand so quickly, but they came from a somewhat higher level because we used so much in the first place.
I'm wondering, though, what about the role of oil speculators?
There is a role of oil speculators, but people often attribute, I think, too much of this to oil speculators. I mean, consider the same speculators are speculating in natural gas, and natural gas are at 10-year lows. Why is that? Because the underlying fundamentals support that price. And so with the oil speculators, if there weren't underlying fundamentals supporting that speculation, they could never drive the price up there and hold it there.
Robert Rapier, in your career as a chemical engineer, you've worked with a lot of different biofuels. What are the most promising bioenergy sources with the least ecological damage?
Well, there's always trade-offs, and that was, I talk about that a lot, that corn ethanol, for instance. Corn ethanol is definitely making a contribution to our energy. At the same time, people argue that it's driven food prices up. It's caused ecological damage as fertilizers and pesticides have run off into the Mississippi River and ended up in the Gulf of Mexico. So every single case, we have a situation where we have to evaluate the trade-offs. You know, we have palm oil. Palm oil is a very good fuel. It makes a very good jet fuel, and yet we're clearing rainforest to put in palm oil plantations. The real hope is algae, and that's still a long ways off, but algae would be ideal because you could grow it on non-arable land and produce fuel that way. And technically it can be done, but the price is still up there pretty high.
And one of the bottom line questions is, could we really produce enough biofuels to replace fossil fuels?
And the answer to that is no. We will not produce enough biofuels to replace oil. The 85 million barrels a day of oil we produce, realistically, if I look out, I'd say we may replace 10, if in the most optimistic scenario, we could replace 20% of that with biofuels before we really get into some serious land use issues and really start cutting down on our ability to grow food for the population.
And what is the difference between methanol and ethanol, and is one of them a better fuel?
Methanol is the simplest alcohol. It has one carbon. Ethanol has two carbons. Both of them function very well as fuels. They both have similar disadvantages toward gasoline. Both of them have lower energy content per gallon. So methanol is about half the energy content of gasoline. Ethanol is about two-thirds. They're both more corrosive than gasoline. So ethanol is more corrosive than gasoline. Methanol is more corrosive than ethanol. But there's been a lot of testing done on both fuels. Methanol has traded cheaper than the price of gasoline for many years. It's normally made from natural gas, but it's one of the world's largest commodity chemicals. It's very easy to produce. We can produce it from natural gas. We can produce it from wood. But it has never enjoyed the kind of political support that ethanol has enjoyed, because ethanol has the farm lobby in the U.S., and that is a very powerful interest group, and they've managed to get legislation passed that really favored ethanol. Methanol had the upper hand two decades ago. California, for instance, had a program where they produced and tested methanol on a pretty large scale. They just never built out sufficient infrastructure. But methanol, for a car that's compatible with it, remains a very good and promising fuel.
And talking about the politics of all this, you have also warned that U.S. taxpayers are subsidizing fuel for Europeans. How could that happen?
Yeah, that is true. That's some traders in Europe brought that up last year. They brought up the fact that ethanol that's being subsidized in the U.S. with tax credits is being blended into gasoline and then shipped over to Europe. So the tax credit is being collected in the U.S., and then so it's subsidized as it's going to Europe, and the Europeans have been protesting this. Now, it's not happening anymore because that tax credit expired at the end of the year, and the ethanol industry denied it. But at the same time, they've denied it. You will see that ethanol exports have plummeted. So following the expiration of that tax credit, and I said that then, I wrote about this a year ago, and I said, well, we'll know when the tax credit expires. If the exports fall, then they probably were benefiting from the tax credit, and they have indeed plummeted.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with alternative energy expert Robert Rapier. We've heard big claims lately that North America is an emerging energy giant once again with trillions of barrels of reserves. What are they talking about, Robert, and where the heck is it?
Well, when they talk about trillions of barrels, what they're really talking about is oil shale out in the Green River Formation in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming. And this oil shale is, it looks like a rock. I mean, you could mistake it for coal. It is essentially oil that Mother Nature didn't finish cooking. So it never got hot enough. It never got enough pressure. And so to process it into oil, you actually have to dig it up, and or there are some processes that actually heat it in the ground, but you have to cook it. And that there's the rub. You have to add energy to it in order to get it to convert it into oil. And so the reserve of that is actually zero. The reserve would be what can economically be produced, and today that number is zero. The resource is huge, but the difference in a resource and a reserve, I sometimes explain to people by talking about the dissolved gold in the oceans. There's trillions of dollars of gold in the oceans, and so that would be the resource. We have an enormous resource of gold in the oceans, but the reserve, what could be economically produced, is zero. You cannot economically produce that gold in the oceans.
You know, after that Keystone Pipeline permit was denied in the U.S., the Canadian government and a big Texas energy company, Kinder Morgan, are plotting to ship that unrefined tar sands product to China and other Asian countries, and they're going to use West Coast Canadian ports. And we've seen big Chinese oil companies putting billions into the tar sands. I'm wondering, is it possible we could see an energy future where North Americans are almost starved for oil, even though it's produced here?
You know, I think Canada's moves make complete sense. And from Canada's perspective, they don't want to be completely reliant on the U.S. market, because our politics are such that, that they change every couple of years, and you just can't have consistency. China, you know you're going to have continuing growing demand from China. So from Canada's perspective, it makes sense to go that direction. It is possible, and one of my biggest fears, and people sometimes misunderstand my position, because I support the Keystone Pipeline, and at the same time I support renewable energy, and people say, how can you support both? And I say, because we're going to have to transition. We're going to have to transition from oil to alternative energy. But during that transition, of course, we're still going to require oil. And one of the worst things that can happen is that we try to transition too quickly and we shift away from oil. We don't develop our oil and the alternatives are not there. And so what happens in that case is indeed we could be starved for energy and see skyrocketing energy prices. The flip side, though, is I've always said we're not going to drill our way to energy independence. We simply don't have the oil. We have a contingency plan there where we are trying to move to alternatives as rapidly as possible, but we have got the insurance policy there of things like the Keystone Pipeline if that transition doesn't happen quickly enough, if the alternatives don't deliver.
I've got to wonder, though, will we really make the transition unless we're forced to? We like the easy oil lifestyle.
We do like it. I mean, we there's a love-hate relationship because we hate the pollution, we hate to see oil-covered birds, but then we also hate to pay higher prices for oil. And historically, you know, the only thing that really impacts us is paying more for oil. I've made some proposals that would actually have us paying more for oil but paying less on other taxes so that it would essentially be a shift in our tax burden from income over into oil. That would speed up a transition. And those are the kinds of things. You're absolutely right. We vote with our pocketbooks. We consume less oil when the price goes up. And so our demand has fallen over the past couple of years on the back of much, much higher oil prices. Ironically, and you might not think this, and I wouldn't have guessed this, I would have guessed that as oil prices went up, the developing countries would be priced out of the oil market. That has not happened. Their demand has grown unabated. And this is why when I started to become skeptical that we would positively address climate change. And when you think about why that is, it finally occurred to me why it is. In the West, we consume 22 barrels of oil per person per year. In China, they consume 2. And so that second barrel of oil to them is worth more than $100. I mean, they would probably pay $200 or $300 if they could just hold on to the 2 barrels they consume. For us, the 22nd barrel is allowing us to drive the 12,000th mile a year. And so we make some small changes, and we cut back a little bit, and so we're able to cut our discretionary demand. Theirs is more a matter of life and death and very basic necessities. And in that case, you can see that they can continue to grow their demand even though prices are much higher because it's just simply buying them things that they've never had before that we take for granted.
Robert Rapier, your new book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. What choices do you recommend in the book?
I talk about a lot of things. You know, I basically try to get people to think about energy in a different way and to think about things they haven't thought about before. You know, we're familiar with the oil-covered birds, but there's also, you know, the wind farms are slicing up, you know, golden eagles and protected species. And that's not to say we shouldn't develop wind farms because, you know, cars also kill birds. So we make those kinds of trade-offs. But I want to be sure people understand the trade-offs. What are the trade-offs from nuclear power? What does it mean to phase out nuclear power? I get into a lot of background information on who uses oil, who uses coal, what the impacts are and what the real trade-offs are that many times are made behind the scenes without our express consent. And then I get into a lot of what are some of the alternatives, how might we move away from oil, and then some specific recommendations such as the tax scheme where we could, you know, taxes, oil taxes are in the U.S., you know, fossil fuel taxes are something that politicians won't touch. But if you put it in a way that said, look, the average person's tax burden is not going to increase at all. It's just that you're going to pay more for gasoline and less for, you know, your income. And the benefit is going to be your kids will have gasoline where they may have very little gasoline now. So if you frame it in as an issue like that, where it's going to benefit future generations, it might be able to be sold. I mean, it's still going to be a difficult sell, but I think the only way you could sell it is to say it's going to be revenue neutral. But in fact, if people make changes, they can actually decrease the amount of taxes they pay because this is much more voluntary. If we shift taxes and we say we're going to give you a tax credit based on the amount of gasoline the average family uses, well, you can cut back your gasoline consumption and suddenly you're paying less taxes. So there's an appeal there. I've also put together a proposal that says, we need to explore and we need to develop our domestic resources, But at the same time, we need to target that money into programs that decrease our dependence on oil. So, you know, I would be selling leases. I would definitely put it in there, put the contract in such a way that if oil prices spike, that the government gets an increasing portion of those revenues. So the windfall is shared between government and private industry. But then I would say take money and earmark it for, you know, a $1,000 rebate for everyone who buys a car that gets 40 miles to the gallon. So I'm trying to address both sides there. I'm trying to make sure supplies are adequate, but that we're reining in demand at the same time.
And I know you write the R-squared column over at Consumer Energy Report. Is there a particular news story you would like to tell us about?
The latest one I've written about is about subsidies, because in the U.S. that's a real political hot topic. And what I have pointed out is many times people don't really realize what these subsidies consist of. And I've given an example where some of the loudest voices against getting rid of subsidies support low-income heating oil assistance. That is classified as an oil subsidy. The OECD has put together a list where they put together supports for fossil fuel, and that is listed as an oil subsidy. So the same people who are screaming, we have to get rid of these subsidies, support that program. Farmers who get a fuel tax exemption on the basis that they're not out using the roads and the fuel taxes pay for the roads, they get a fuel tax exemption. That was the second largest category of oil subsidies. So, you know, people have an impression that these subsidies are cash payments to oil companies, when in fact, many times they're supporting, like the farmers certainly don't want to get rid of that fuel tax exemption, and at the same time they would say, we don't support oil subsidies. So people don't really understand what they are. And that was my point is, we need to, if we're going to have an intelligent discussion about this, people really need to understand what they are, what their purpose is, and what the impact of getting rid of them would be.
Well, now, as my last question, I want to say that some of my listeners are really nervous that the economy could stall or even crash because we didn't adapt to declining energy. How serious do you think our situation is?
I think that, you know, the problem is, you know, we still have this growing demand from all the developing countries. And as we emerge from recession, always our demand for oil goes up. And what happens when demand for oil goes up is the price goes up and can put us back into recession. So I actually talk about this in the book. I've called the scenario after Jim Kunstler's The Long Emergency, I call it the long recession. It's the recession that every time you try to emerge from, you go back into recession because you've driven oil prices up. And that is only going to happen when we don't have the ability to grow our oil supplies further. And we may be at that point. And so it is very serious. If we don't transition away from oil quickly enough, we will be in this never-ending cycle of recession simply because demand will continue to grow every time we come out.
Well, I like your point of view there. We've been talking with Robert Rapier. He's a chemical engineer employed by America International. Robert is a prolific energy commentator on the net and in mainstream media. His new book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. Robert, thank you so much for sharing time with us.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Seth Moser-Katz.
And Justin Ritchie from The Extra Environmentalist. And today, we're speaking with Michael McGonigal for Radio EcoShock. Michael McGonigal, you are a political economist, environmental lawyer, professor at University of Victoria, and one of the co-founders of Greenpeace International. And today we're here to talk about your ideas on where the environmental movement has been and where it's going. Business as usual has been pushing forward, and it's been trying to return the economies of Europe and the world to the usual form of economic growth that we've been seeing for the last few decades. So what hope do the activists of today have for changing the system that we live in, and what kind of issues should they be focusing on?
That's an interesting question on a whole bunch of levels. But one of the things that I dislike, quite honestly, is the word hope. And there's a very good discussion about that by Derek Jensen in his book, Endgame, where he talks about hope is a bad word. It's kind of a con job because, you know, well, we can't really make any difference, but we can always hope. And his thing is, and I agree with this, there is no hope. The machine is cranking on, but who cares? So we just do what we can do. And we can enjoy doing what we can do. We can celebrate life in the process. So I would say that for the activists of today, the hope of turning this machine around is essentially non-existent and will require serious shocks to that system for changes to take place. But I don't think that really matters in that, I mean, it's frustrating, of course, but in that we just have to do what has to be done and understand what has to be done. And another problem with the word hope is that so much of what people do is tailored to being realistic, to being acceptable, not to step out of line, not to use terms like capitalism or growth. God forbid to use terms like that in a critical way because, oh, you get discredited. So from that, the number one things activists, I think, have to do is to understand really well and work really hard to understand the dynamics of the systems that we have on this planet and to bring those out into the public consciousness and to talk about them and to put forward ideas which really go to the core of the crisis of capital, the crisis of the state and state regulation that we all need to start looking at, because there's huge possibilities. I mean, in terms of changing the system, if we decided to, oh my gosh, there's millions of things we could do, but we can't do that because we don't understand it, we don't see it, we kind of naturalize it. So the number one thing I would say that environmentalists need to do is to denaturalize capitalism, denaturalize the state system, the regulatory system, the way we think, and say these are constructed, and take them apart and actually renaturalize. Say then what are the things that we need to start with? What are the fundamentals we need to get back to?
You started off with a really bold statement that you don't feel that hope is something that people should be relying on. Can you take us back to when you started becoming an activist, maybe in the 60s and 70s? What was it like back then, and what has changed from then to now?
Well, you know, David Suzuki, Canada's famous environmentalist, a couple of weeks ago was quoted in the papers having said that environmentalism has basically been wasting its time for the last 20 years because we shouldn't have been talking about environmental stuff. We should have been talking about growth. And I agree with that. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, I was stupid back in those days. I thought I knew something, but really I was just obsessed about killing whales and how terrible it was, and we had to stop that. And I was not really that aware of the dynamics of capital and so on, which is what drives the whole process. So in those days, it was really very issue specific. In my part of the world, in BC, where I was in Vancouver, it was, you know, the Greenpeace issues. Their big concern was BC Hydro because it was building all these dams. No one was even concerned in the least about forestry, which then became, of course, the big issue in Canada. It was naively optimistic, and it was a simpler time, in fact. I don't think even the industrialized power structures were aware that we couldn't have both our economic growth machine and environmental quality. I mean, the whole movement of environmentalism in the States in the 60s, Nixon was behind a lot of the great legislation that went through in the late 60s and 70s in the United States, and they thought we could have it all. We could have clean water and clean air and healthy forests, and all we need to do is better regulation, more efficiency, and so on. So it was kind of a naive time, and I was certainly a part of that. I just thought we can stop it. I mean, and we were successfully in Greenpeace, and that's what I was doing in the 70s and 80s, and it was fighting the whaling industry. And we won, quote unquote. We got a global moratorium back in 1982. 30 years later, they're still whaling, and there's still way worse pressure on the oceans. So we were fighting specific issues and thinking we were winning, but we weren't.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.